So when I talk about the book, I always say that the main story is of a young woman who was born in London, but at an early age moved to Ghana because her mother died and spent her formative years in Ghana. And then the beginning of her 20s, she finds out that she has a sister that lives in Germany. So we meet this young woman when she's in Germany. She's pregnant by now, looking for a place to live, split up from the partner. And when the reader reaches that part of the novel, set in 2019, and it's in the second half of the book, and when the reader reaches that part, they'll begin to realize that there's certain names that keep repeating, certain themes, ideas, constellations of people like friends and people like that around her, and they realize that these are echoes of things that have happened in the past. They know more actually about what's happening to her than she does herself.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Akadi Magazine's Connecting Communities podcast. My name is Abna Selwa and you were just listening to Sharon Dodua Otu, German-British Ghanaian author of Ada's Realm, a book described as genre-busting and time-bending that has already split opinion since its launch earlier this year. In this episode, which is a two-parter, we speak to Sharon about the genesis of this novel and why aspects of Ghana's cultures, languages and histories feature so prominently in the book. And if you've listened to our review of Ada's Realm, we directed a question to Sharon which she answers in this episode. Have a listen and tell us if you've read Ada's Realm and what you thought of it. Sharon, thank you so much for giving us some of your time to talk about Ada's Realm.
You're very welcome. Thank you for asking for this interview.
I know that you've had a lot of people summarise the book and sort of give their interpretation, but I'm really keen to find out how you would describe Ada's Realm.
Yeah, so when I talk about the book, I always say that the main story is of a young woman who was born in London, but at an early age moved to Ghana because her mother died and spent her formative years in Ghana. And then the beginning of her 20s, she finds out that she has a sister that lives in Germany. So we meet this young woman when she's in Germany. She's pregnant by now, looking for a place to live, split up from the partner. And when the reader reaches that part of the novel, set in 2019, and it's in the second half of the book, and when the reader reaches that part, they'll begin to realise that there's certain names that keep repeating, certain themes, ideas, constellations of people like friends and people like that around her, and they realise that these are echoes of things that have happened in the past. They know more actually about what's happening to her than she does herself. And the first half of the novel, where all this historical part is drawn from, takes place in three separate realms, which is 15th century West Africa and the place which is now Ghana, 19th century England, London, and then 1945 in Germany. So you've got this historical part in the first half, and then it all culminates in the second half in 2019. And then in the middle, there's like a kind of brief exchange between two entities, one of them being God and the other being a being, I call it a being, that desperately wants to come to Earth as a human and have its chance to experience its own history and life, but has to pass a kind of test. And the book is kind of discussing what could that be that this being has to do. So the being is learning as it goes through the story, and in the middle you kind of find out a little bit more about what it all means, how it all hangs together.
Thank you for that. I absolutely enjoyed the book, but I cannot understand how you were able to draw so much complex stories, people, languages. It's so rich. How did you manage to do that?
I'm going to say, honestly, I was a bit overambitious. So when I had the idea in my head, I was like, yeah, this could totally work. And then when I started to write, it cost me a lot of energy to keep going. But the original idea for the novel came, in fact, from a short story. And this was a short story that ended up winning a really important literary prize in Germany.
Okay.
The short story has been translated into English as well by now. One translation calls it Herr Grotrup sits down, and the other one is Herr Grotrup takes a seat. So it's about a married couple and they have an argument about how long it takes to boil an egg. You've not read this story, have you?
No.
So let me just be very brief. So they have this argument every morning about how long it takes to boil an egg, and he always wins because he's the scientist and he knows that if you boil an egg for 7.5 minutes exactly, then the perfect hardness will be achieved. And then on this morning, the egg is still soft.
Okay.
So he has a crisis about that. What the heck is going on? And the middle point of the story, the turning point, is that the egg starts to narrate. And this is the being that is in Ada's realm. In the short story, the being is narrating about how it's so frustrated that this man is, you know, always arguing with his wife and being so rude. And he kind of wants to teach the man a lesson, and it goes on like that. It's kind of like a satire. And in the short story, the cleaning lady makes an appearance right at the very end, and the cleaning lady is called Ada. So that was the beginning. And having won that prize,
Is that the Ingeborg?
Ingeborg Bachmann Prize. Yeah. Ingeborg Bachmann Prize. And I decided, with the opportunity that I then had, to expand this short story and make it into a full-blown novel. So I'd had the idea about how it all hung together quite early. But in the end, when I was working on the novel, I had to kind of discard the short story because it had a life of its own. You know, it was like a lot of people were reading and discussing it, and it had a particular tone, which I liked. It was a very satirical story, but it didn't fit for what I was going for the novel. So the story itself doesn't appear in the novel, but people who know both can see the links.
Yeah, so when you had the prayer, the broom, and it's the, I don't know, the being, or it's almost seeing, the all-seeing.
Yeah.
Because it sees what happens to Ada at the beginning.
Yeah.
I like that, because then you had the doorknob later on. So that was really, really cool. And I've not often seen that kind of other sort of omnipresent
perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't either. And one of the reasons I chose that was because I often read books that are told in like the third person.
Yeah.
I forgot what it's called. I should know this. Third person narrative or something. And these third people perspectives know everything, and they kind of are always right. And I was like, yeah, but I don't agree with that. You know, I know that I myself am a flawed being. So if I'm writing a story, it's going to have my perspective in there. So I didn't want to write something where it was like it was very clear that whatever the narrator was saying was absolutely not to be questioned, 100% correct. I liked that in my narration there are doubts and mistakes and flaws, yeah.
And that's quite central to the book, I think, because it has different names depending on where you get the book.
Yes,
you know.
Yes.
And I've been ruminating over whether Ada is the same person in these different eras, or if it's different time realms. Yeah, realms.
I like that you say that. Yeah. I haven't decided myself either. And sometimes I catch myself saying it's one woman who's lived many times. And then sometimes I catch myself saying it's four different women who are linked. And I like that it's open. I prefer it for people to make up their own mind how they would read that.
But I almost think that's brave as well, because usually when you read a book, people who've, maybe the authors will go, well, it's this, or when it's discussed, most people have quite a clear view of what it is. But I really feel like you're quite relaxed about people seeing it however they see it, and it all being valid.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting, because you can just keep revisiting. I haven't decided. I mean, I think the bracelet for me tied them all together.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
And then I did see that link where they all I don't want to spoil it, but the demise of the three of them is all connected.
Yes.
And all of that stuff. And also the role of these men in their lives as well.
Yes.
So I just wasn't sure if it was the same Ada or different ones, but I feel like the fourth Ada, there's some sort of clarity that happens, so it's not a repetition of what they went through.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right?
Yes, I like that reading, and I like that there were things that I wanted to kind of look at from different perspectives. I'll give you an example. The relationship between the second Ada, the Lady Ada Lovelace, and her maid, Lizzie. So it's a difficult dynamic, right? And there was something I wanted to expose in that dynamic, because Otherwise, you could read that this woman, Ada, and her best friend or sister, they are always just loving each other. They're friends and they never have any problems. But in this England, 19th century England story, you can see that there's a tension. And I wanted that tension, if the reader would like to read it that way, to be exposed also in the later, in all of the relationships.
Yeah.
So in 2019, you have Ada and her sister Elle, and then you see, oh yeah, there's this anger or whatever that was already there in the past. So that was something I wanted, yeah.
And that's nice, because I think it's more authentic. Relationships aren't perfect, and although books you can create that perfection, I like that there isn't, because it's relatable, you know.
Yeah,
but there's still beauty in it. I particularly liked the opening, because you know this is quite a traumatic experience of the first Ada, who's in what we now call Ghana, and going through childbirth and having this beautiful baby that unfortunately doesn't live, and that's beautiful and it's horrible at the same time. And I think normally when we think about motherhood, it's always, oh, it's brilliant.
Absolutely.
Oh, you're blooming, and like the woman's suffering because you know.
Absolutely. And you know, there's two readings of that opening scene that I've heard people giving me feedback. So generally people I don't know reviewers or such, they would say, oh, this book is so heavy and it opens with such a horrible scene, not horrible but traumatic, it's all about how women suffer, something like this. And then once I was doing a reading in Germany, twice it happened to me, two different readings actually, and women have come up to me and said, I had that experience, that thing that happened right at the beginning, that was me, and it was so healing for me to read this depiction, because it's not in literature otherwise, and also to read all the way through to the end where there's a kind of a closure, which is hopeful, and they thanked me for that story. So like, I accept as an author that people aren't always going to love what I've produced, and that's got to be okay, of course. But of course, when someone can actually really, I don't know, I feel literature can do that, you know, literature can give you the opportunity to turn your pain into something beautiful and valuable. And so I'm really happy to hear that this happened for some people who read it.
So how were you able to tap into that? Because I feel...
So there's a lot that happens in the novel that has nothing to do with my lived experience, I have to say. So for example, all of my children, the pregnancies were... they were healthy pregnancies. I stayed pregnant to full term. The births were uncomplicated, all of them.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. But what I think I would share is everybody has had heartache, or everyone's maybe experienced having a broken heart, or having lost a loved one through death, or having been badly treated by someone and feeling furious about it. And these really strong emotions, that's where I draw it. I tend to write around really, really strong emotions and then create a plot out of that. But this is you know, you experience crap, you know, you could go down the street and someone calls you a name, or you know, I don't know, and then you're left there with this feeling, what can you do? And at least I have the opportunity to write a story, maybe turn it into a satire, make myself laugh and give that to other people. So that's really a wonderful opportunity.
And I identified a lot with Ada 4, number 4. Although she was in Germany, a lot of what she experienced, even flying from Ghana to, I think initially,
to
Britain,
London,
and then coming. Yeah, and all of those, what would we call it, sort of microaggressions that you experience as a black person.
Yeah.
And, you know, that dread, she's trying to look for somewhere to live, and all they see is...
Yeah,
she's black or whatever, you know, and having to go through all of that again and again, it's re-traumatizing yourself. And sometimes if you don't experience it or know that that happens, it's hard for you to understand.
That's true.
What people are going through.
And that part where she was looking for a place to live, that wasn't even the main story for me, right? I was thinking, okay, the book's going to be called Ada's Raum in German, and... yeah, there can be a room that she's looking for, you know, and so there was this story.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Why didn't I? Of course.
Yes. So for me, that wasn't the main thing. It was like, yeah, she's going to look for a place to live. And of course, as a black woman, she's going to experience this and this and this, right? But the story was, she's looking for a place to live because you know, like Giovanni's Room or A Room of One's Own from Virginia Woolf. It was that. And then someone read the book, a white German guy, older guy, and he was like, wow, I did not realize how hard it is. And I was like, there you go. It's not like we've never spoken about it, right?
Yeah.
It's just, it has to be put in some kind of soil that you connect to emotionally.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know. I feel like you've answered it and lots of people have, but who were you writing it for? Can you say, maybe initially, who did you think this would appeal to?
It was, there's kind of a few answers because I guess initially it was just for me because I knew I wanted to tell this story and the person who will understand everything that I put in this story, I mean, I think it's only me, right? But then I thought that's okay because I've also read many things that I've loved but not understood all. Like my favorite book of all time is Beloved by Toni Morrison. I don't think I've understood everything in that book and I've read it so often. Right? So, and then what is this need to understand everything? I honestly think that's a kind of a colonial viewpoint on the world. Like, you know, I'm an expert. I know it all. And I'm like, no, we don't. And it's okay to not know stuff. It's okay to be a little bit uncertain and to ask someone, what did you think? Because I thought this, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Right? So I knew my book would be a book that would make people feel uncertain and uncomfortable, and I was okay with that.
Yeah.
But I think those people who are prepared to just go with that feeling,
yeah,
I think at the end they get the most out of it.
Yeah.
It's those people who read my book and think, I've got to understand it all, that end up hating it. You know? So in the first instance, it was me. And then in the second instance, I did want to write a book where people were marginalized for racism reasons, sexism reasons, having disabilities. I wanted them to be able to read the book and not feel, oh, this is another book that kind of puts me down, another book that uses my identity as an insult or as a joke.
Mm.
So that was another thing that was important to me.
Wow.
And then sometimes I say, I think at my book premiere, I said, I wrote it as a love letter to Germany. And what I meant was, the book is not supposed to be bashing Germany, even though I think some people have read it like that. It wasn't supposed to be bashing people. It was supposed to say, with all the difficulties I experience living here, I still choose this as my home. And I want to have a positive effect. You know, I want to take what I've got and leave it a bit better than I arrived when I arrived. And this is my contribution. You know, I want to also work with the German language and say, this is also what you can do with it. You can also insert a bit of tree. I'm proudest about that, by the way.
I just want you to know, clapping. I'm clapping to Sharon.
That there are all these books on the shelves in Germany with tree in them. Hallelujah!
I want to talk about that.
Yes.
Because you not only do you put tree in there, but there's Ga in there as well.
So Ga is actually the language of my parents. Yes. I don't speak tree. Actually, I don't speak Ga even. But if, then Ga, right? But then there was, I think you remember, there was a little bit of a discussion at the end about how many Ghanaians speak Tree, even those who actually speak Ghan. All of that was important for me to include.
But what I noticed about the book, because a lot of the references are known to me and would have been known to Ghanaians, I didn't feel like you felt the need to explain it. And I loved that.
Because
it's kind of like when we are reading books from other places, you know, we don't get an explanation.
No.
So it requires you. And I think I'd read like a critique where some people had said that it was difficult to follow.
Yeah.
And for me, it's like, well, that's kind of how we can sometimes feel, you know, when we're in a strange environment. But for me, this was really connected to my culture.
Yeah.
And I felt like it was that path. You don't even have to... we know it, it's sort of embedded in us. So that's why I liked how you introduced it, started off with Ghana.
That was a deliberate move. It had to begin with Ghana and it had to begin with pre-colonial. It had to start with, because you know, there's this notion that Africa has no history, blah blah blah, or everything you learn in school typically starts with a black person in chains, right? So I needed to go before that.
So for me it was beautiful and I loved the movement between the different worlds. So I was looking forward to seeing what happened in Stratford Le Bow or and then, you know, in you know, Nazi Germany. It was really nice, and then for me it meant that it flowed and it was quite I read it quickly in 4 days. I read it. So the beginning part or the first section is my favourite.
Okay.
And that's why I think it would be great for a film or a TV series or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in terms of where I wanted to explore, we sort of talked about this gatekeeping and ownership of narratives.
Mm-hmm.
So because you talk about quite a gruesome part of German history,
mm-hmm.
And it was quite interesting when you had that webinar that I attended and you talked about something I didn't know, these women that happened to end up being prostitutes to service people who we sort of imagine... I just couldn't imagine that they'd have been serviced in that way before going into a gas chamber. I don't know.
Yeah, that wasn't... So there are many different... There are many different concentration camps in Germany.
Okay.
Some of them were so-called extermination camps. So, for example, the one that most people knows the name of is Auschwitz.
Yeah.
And that those are the ones where people arrived and then were kind of like very crudely processed and good enough to work and then not useful and then sent to the gas chambers. The concentration camp that I was writing about, though, was a place called Mittelbau Dora. And that was, I think you would call it, a place where people were enslaved, forced to work on building bombs.
Okay.
They weren't sent to gas. That wasn't the main purpose. It wasn't an extermination camp. If they were punished and killed through punishment, that was a different dynamic, if you will. So they were predominantly men. Actually, it was mostly men at that concentration camp until they decided that they were going to open up these brothels. And then there was another concentration camp which was called Ravensbrück, and Ravensbrück was the place where predominantly women were kept. And they, I'm using air quotes here, they recruited women prisoners from Ravensbrück and brought them over to one of these brothels was at Mittelbau Dora, and these women were then forced into prostitution there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I learned so much from reading the book because I didn't know that existed. And then when we had your discussion, it's this idea of binaries, you know, we see victimhood or we see the victims and then we see the perpetrators. And not to say that if you are engaging in this act, it means that you're not a perpetrator. It's just we have quite a narrow view of how you're treated. So, I mean, similarly, it's like the discussion when we talk about enslavement and slavery in African settings and the role of chiefs in that.
Because absolutely.
We need to preserve this binary, otherwise it's a difficult conversation.
Yeah.
And I feel like you touch on that, although you're not talking about, you know, Nazi Germany, like generally and, you know, what happened, you're talking about a specific thing. So I was interested in just you maybe exploring on that. Is it called the Shoah?
Shoah, yeah. Yeah, so within Germany, and so I live in Germany, I work in Germany, I raise my children in Germany, I am literally German now, I've got the German nationality, I'm part of that discussion. Within Germany, the Shoah is very, very marked as a discourse that's very clear, and that has a lot to do with the historical responsibility of non-Jewish Germans. Many of the people who live today are descended from people who were Nazis and who were engaged in these atrocities, setting up these concentration camps, deporting, you know, your neighbours, literally living next door to you, were deported, sent into concentration camps and then exterminated. And many people are living with that guilt, either them personally, but they're dying now, or their children or grandchildren. So there's a responsibility in the public discourse to take that very seriously and not do anything to diminish that. And then comes along someone like me and people are not sure what to do with that I write about an aspect of the Shoah. The person I write about, the third Adar, is not Jewish in this concentration camp that I talked about, Mittelbau Dora and Ravensbrück. They recruited women, but because of the racist and anti-Semitic laws at the time, Jewish Germans or Jewish Europeans were not allowed, air quotes again, to have sex with non-Jewish Germans or non-Jewish Europeans. So you had a situation where anyway the Jewish people were considered to be less than human and they were not allowed to participate in this brothel and forced prostitution situation. Therefore the women there were, at least if they were Jewish, they have hidden their identity so well that no one knows that. So these women are there and being forced into prostitution, and I write about that experience, and that experience has not been looked at. I mean, the only place I know where it's been discussed before was in non-fiction books. I know of three books where the authors did research with source material and wrote about it. But it was a very difficult subject to research on and write about because it was so taboo. Mm. It was taboo to talk about. These women were actually classed as asocial. Mm. So for the longest time, asocial people were considered to... It was considered to be their own fault that they had ended up in that situation, you know. So they weren't accessing any kind of compensation or any apology for what they experienced. So these women were considered to be asocial, and then of course they themselves are not going to go out and talk about their experiences in public. They didn't want to do that. And then, like I said, you've got a very clear idea for most non-Jewish Germans that it was the Germans who were to blame for what happened, it was the Germans who were at fault, and the others were the victims. Hmm. So if you then introduce a dynamic where, and the SS, the soldiers, the German soldiers, are very good at this, of kind of creating different classes of prisoners and then putting the prisoners against each other, yeah. pitting them against yeah. each other. That was part of their power, right? So if you start to talk about how different prisoners behave to each other, then it all gets really difficult, especially from a German position. Mm. I, though, grew up in Britain, so I didn't carry inherently this feeling that this subject isn't right for me to talk about. I didn't bring that to the table. And it's not to say that I thought I have a right to write it. That wasn't really my thing. Some people like are critical of my role in that. But my thing was more this short story that I told you about, Herr Grotrup Sits Down. Herr Grotrup was also based on a real figure. Mm. The real Herr Grotrup worked during Nazi Germany as a scientist and developed these rockets, the V2 rockets, that were built in Mittelbau-Dora, were built on his design. And when I first thought I'm going to write a novel, I wanted to research more about this guy to find out what did he know about the conditions under which his rockets were being built. And it was then that I found out that there were these brothels, and then it was then that I found out about all these complications about who was accessing the brothels and who was actually being forced into prostitution there. And it was clear to me that it was already clear to me that my novel was going to be about trauma and it was going to be about women. And then it was like, yeah, this is the story that I need to put a spotlight on. Mm. And that was my, as a writer, I have access. I can take part in interviews and travel and so on. So I'm like, this is what I can do, is I can use this part of my work to create a memorial for these women because they're not really talked about otherwise. Yeah.
And almost, do you think that your position of as an outsider, in a sense, maybe gives you that space to be able to do that?
Emotionally, definitely. Yeah. I don't mean I'm an outsider, therefore I can write about it. I mean, as a person who wasn't socialised in Germany, I just didn't carry that emotional weight.
Yeah.
So definitely. But I also want to add that there is additional aspect to this, is that in concentration camps, black people were also there. And it was pretty much, it didn't matter where you came from as a black person, you were so visible on the streets, and you could easily be arrested and also deported and also sent to a concentration camp to be exterminated. And that is something that I'm acutely aware of. When I was applying for German citizenship, I had such mixed feelings because I knew that it could easily, if the right party gets into power, they could easily say, no, actually, there's no such thing as a black German. Mm. It's happened before. Mm. 1935, it happened. I don't see any reason why it can't happen again. Mm. So it was really important to me that I still retained my British citizenship.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, I feel like a nod to Ada Four.
Yes.
You know, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm. And then she's like, shit, Brexit. My British citizenship doesn't mean anything anymore. I went through, that's exactly what I was thinking. I was like, look, I thought I was so safe in Europe with my, I'm a sovereign Briton. And then all of a sudden, some random Boris Johnson comes in and that's all this certainty is gone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's very much what it was about.
But just going back, because you talked about the concentration camps, and we know that prior to that we have those concentration camps
in Namibia.
Whatever
it was called then. Yeah.
So again, because that was Southwest German
Southwest Africa.
Yeah. So again, there's the connection.
Yes.
So almost like the claim to who can talk about it, going back to gatekeeping. Yeah. Why can't you?
Why can't I? It's a very good question. Like I said, it's like, so there's a phenomenon right now called the, what would you call it in English? In German, it's called historiker Streits, which literally means the argument of the historians or the debate of the historians. And this argument is around the question of, to what extent can you consider the Shoah side by side with other genocides or atrocities? Even, you know, the act of comparing is unheard of. And so for many Germans, like, no, it's a no-go. The Shoah was one thing and nothing comes close to it. And then there are some historians that say, well, how are you going to be able to say nothing compares to it unless you compare? That's the whole, that's our job, right? To draw out criteria to say, why is it so unique? And to do that, you have to be able to compare it. And it's a very heated emotional debate, and I completely understand that. And I'm not jumping in to say who's right and who's wrong, but I just want to say it must be possible for us to stay in conversation. And it must be possible for us, for me as a Black British German woman, to be able to say, okay, so here is my two cents. You know, I know that if I had been living at that time, it would have affected me too, very, very personally. I don't want to take away from anyone's experience by saying that. I just want to say I have a perspective on this that I would like to share. What do you think?
Yeah. Absolutely. And also the fact that some of the ways that people were dehumanized in those settings started on the African continent, some of those experiments.
So
actually that was the precursor to what we're sometimes not allowed to touch or talk about in a different way. There's like a protection around it.
It's really sad because I think there are many people who belong to different groups of descendants of people who have experienced genocide. And the way I experience those discussions is usually one of solidarity and saying we've got to stick together. We've got to, that this division of who suffered the most is not helping anybody. It's actually only helping the right wingers who want to destroy us all. None of us are going to win that, right? And I like the solidarity and the strength of solidarity that can come from people coming together and saying, yeah, I see you in your humanity. And that's really what I wanted to do with the book, was to show, it wasn't important to me to show suffering. That wasn't actually my main point. My main point was to say, within all these different experiences of suffering, people have always held on to their humanity. They've always found a way, I've always tried to find a way to still say human. And even if it's they're imagining themselves out of their bodies, and, you know, looking at the world from the moon, right? Or imagining cooking recipes. That's not even something I made up. That's literally, there are literally books on concentration camp recipes, right? That come from an experience of the people like we are. So the reason I wanted to write things like that is because I thought to myself, living in 2019 or in now 2023, and thinking, what the hell is going on in this world? How can I keep positive and optimistic when the politics look like they do? And then I think back to the people who were enslaved and dragged to the Americas. How did they keep hold of their language, their music, their food recipes, the stuff that we now can draw from?
Yeah.
I'm looking at you with your earrings, you're looking at me with mine. Like, they fought so hard to keep on to their humanity and pass it down. And I think that's really what I wanted to make strong in the book.
And I feel like, for me, I mean, I didn't see any of the women as victims. I particularly Ada 3. So in the concentration camps, what she has to do, and then putting on a brave face and then getting on with her day, knowing what she has to, you know, who she has to service and the state that they're in when they come to her and all of that stuff. I just thought, wow, that's amazing, you know. And similarly with Ada 1, who I think she's my favourite just because it's Ghana and everything like that. So, I mean, moving on, there are two things that I wanted to talk about, which we mentioned offline. So I got this sense that with Ada 1, her unit was very female heavy, or I didn't see any men. I mean, I think the men weren't around.
Yeah, that's true.
But then there was a reference twice to wives.
Yes.
Yes.
And then I think I asked you, like, am I reading this wrong? I felt like there was this reference to lesbianism.
Yes.
Yeah.
I feel like lesbianism is a very modern word.
Yeah.
And I feel like we would, with our view now, we would say they were lesbians. I want to say that they were in roles. Like, it was a role to own land and to take care of children, like, in the sense of providing for them. Mm. And if the man was gone, then a woman could also fulfill that role. So the woman would take care of all the wives and so on. And there's a book that exists that I really want to read, which talks more in depth about that. The book was Boy Wives and Female Husbands in Sunny Press. And I read one chapter, I think, because I'd already heard that concepts of gender and relations between the binary sexes were much more fluid in indigenous communities all over the world, and I imagined it must be the same in West Africa. And this particular book that I read talked a little bit about that, and I saw that there was certain roles that had to be. It wasn't so important whether somebody was a man or a woman, it was more about the roles that they had and the seniority that they had, and therefore it could happen that two women were married and living together. And I liked that. I wanted to have that represented, particularly at this moment in time when, anyway, I, as a straight person who's a cis woman, can see what's going on with queer people, trans people around the world. And I thought, I can't remain silent on that. Again, going back to the point that I was making, that marginalized people reading my book shouldn't feel excluded, right? So I wanted that to be referenced. And I also know, like, of course, this happened after the book was published, but in Uganda, this new law that was passed, I knew that this was kind of coming. I know that there are discussions like that in Ghana, and it was just really important for me to say, well, what I know is this cannot be true, that LGBT issues only came in with the colonialists. I don't see it.
Yeah.
It's quite the opposite.
Yeah.
And it would be so beautiful if we could get back to our own indigenous truth on this issue.
But it goes back to what you said about colonialism, even how books are written, because it's usually quite linear and maybe chronological usually, but the way that your book moves between time and it challenges and questions a lot of things, I feel like you're almost doing that, because you're bringing up things that people, for example, Ada 3 and, you know, the prostitution, most people don't know about, but you're bringing those things to the surface and saying, well, let's discuss that. One thing that I thought was really interesting is about just your approach to writing it, which you do talk about before, but it is, you know, it isn't linear, and we're really forced to pay attention a lot of the time.
It's an easy, relaxed read.
Yeah. And also because there's so many questions, like, for example, the name Ada, Ada Fwa. Is that how you say it?
I don't know. I was going to ask you.
I've been going around asking people.
Ada Fwa.
Yeah.
So I assumed it must have been back in the day fort, you know, F-O-R-T.
Oh, okay.
Like where ships are. I don't know. And so Ada Fwa, but...
Yeah. But just the fact that even the name changes.
Yeah.
Ada, Ada. It's amazing because, again, it's this fluidity. And I feel like in so many aspects of how you write, what you write about, it forces us to take a responsibility on where we're basically going to sit. Yeah. So, yeah, I really like that about the book. One thing that I did want to talk about, just going back to gatekeeping, when we look at the Ghanaian narrative, and I did sort of highlight the reference to Obuasi mines.
Thank you for that, yes.
That period, and actually the mines don't exist at that time. But if you could explain why you felt it was important to have...
Want to know what Sharon said? Head over to part two, where she explains more and talks about how she's helping to amplify the work of up-and-coming Afro-German writers. Thank you for listening to this episode. To listen to more content like this, visit our monthly Akadi magazine Connecting Communities podcast on Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprout, or wherever you listen to your audio. Follow our news on akadimagazine.com and akadimagazine.co.uk. and access exclusive early release content and discounts at ko-fi.com/Acadi Magazine. The music in this episode is called Life No Day Easy by Chechaku and the Super Pong Stars, and is a special remix exclusively for Acadi Magazine. Super Pong Stars is a high-octane patchwork of Ghana's indigenous genres, including palm wine music, high life, Afrobeat and Afrofunk. You can find out more about the band on their Instagram, Super Pong Stars. Thank you.